At this summit, I think it became apparent to a lot of them that he is in some early stage of dementia. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor, and I'm rejoining my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Both of us have been on vacation, but we're back, tanned, ready, and rested, as somebody once said of Richard Nixon. Elliot, how are you? Where are you?
I'm doing very well. I think you and I are going to talk about our two interesting trips, yours to Transylvania, of all places, and mine to France later on. But at the moment, I'm in Calgary, home of the Calgary Stampede. And I promise not to wear this for the rest of the show. But actually, you know, we're going to go to the Stampede Fairgrounds this afternoon. But this morning, we went to the military museum that they have here. And the military museum is actually 8 different museums for the Canadian Army, Navy, Air Force, and then for a number of the regiments in the Canadian Army that were raised here. And I wanted to mention, first, it's a terrific museum, really well laid out, a lot of artifacts, a lot of dioramas, the interpretation is done very, very well. But on a serious note, what really struck me is when you go to one of the regimental museums was for the Princess Patricia's Corps of Light Infantry, the PPCLI, sometimes called either the Patricia's or the Princess Pat's. It was the first Canadian unit that went into Afghanistan actually shortly after 9/11. But they served there throughout, and they, like all regimental museums that I've ever seen, they had a memorial room with the names of all those from the regiment who had fallen. I counted 60 names from Afghanistan, and you know, it was just a part of me which wished I wish I could drag Donald Trump and some of his minions here and make them stare at that wall for a little bit before they say some of the things they say about people who fell fighting at our side in a war that began on American soil. So that I had that somewhat grim thought. But I guess, as always, I mean, we have so much jackassery to catch up on, Eric. Why don't you begin, and then I'll make my modest contribution.
All right. Well, I've got a couple of instances of jackassery. One is the White House released a report called Saving America's Story, which is a indictment of the Smithsonian Institution for being subject to ideological capture by the woke mind virus, replete with an endorsement from the Wall Street Journal. You know, I have my own criticisms. You and I have had criticisms of the Academy and how it teaches American history. And certainly I've in the past had criticisms of the Smithsonian. Particularly the Enola Gay exhibit that they had a number of years ago about the aircraft that dropped the atomic bomb in Hiroshima. But this, you know, having perused this report, it's bad faith. Whatever criticisms they make that have merit are washed away by the selective quotation and by the fact that this is part of a larger ideological project to whitewash American history. And you see it in Trump's firing of the head of the National Portrait Gallery because he wanted the references to his impeachment removed from below his portrait. You see it in his own presidential portrait gallery, which has all these tendentious things about presidents he doesn't like. As well as what's been done in our national parks, where various historical exhibits have been bowdlerized. So that's my first instance of jackassery.
If I can just comment on that.
Sure.
And as always, you know, you and I always have these small but sometimes interesting differences. On that one, I think I'm kind of where Chuck Lane our friend Chuck Lane was on Harvard, where he said the problem is that the administration is framing a guilty man.
Yeah.
No, I think that's probably a bit too harsh on the Smithsonian. But I have to say, I last went to the American History Museum a few years ago. It was during the Biden administration. Frankly, I thought it was kind of a mess in terms of telling the American story. It really didn't. And you could tell that they were leaning over backwards to, in the direction of what the French would call bien pensant opinion. And I think it's a problem. You know, the difficulty really is, I mean, the American past is tremendously important to who we are and how we became that way. There are large parts of it which have to be contested, and some parts which are very problematic. I have to say, last time I was at Monticello, I was fairly impressed that they managed to tell the Jefferson story, I thought, in a pretty reasonable way. That is to say, you know, there was a big exhibit on the lives of the slaves there and the sometimes complicated relationship that Jefferson had with slaves, but it didn't.
Including Sally Hemings. Yeah, there's a big exhibit there. Yeah.
I mean, and it was complicated. But they also made it clear that, I mean, Jefferson is not simply famous for having been a slave owner.
Trish and I were just at Monticello last fall, and I agree. I think they've done an excellent job. I don't think you and I actually disagree about this.
No.
I think the real issue here is that, you know, there are excesses here on both sides. Yeah. There is the world of the 1619 Project, which is a very flawed view of American history, which has been denounced by a number of liberal historians, like my former graduate school classmate Sean Wilentz at Princeton.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, he was eloquent on that subject.
Yeah, but then there's the 1776 Project that you know the Trump administration in the first term released, and this report to me was very redolent of that, which is, you know, the other extreme, which is to paper over all the, you know, the ugly stuff. I agree in general that the way we teach history now, American history now, both in the secondary schools and in university, is, you know, it's a series of problems. It's the problem of women. It's the problem of race. It's the problem of class. As opposed to anything that, you know, is redemptive or uplifting about the American story. But again, you know, I think that there are, you know, good, I would say, liberal historians like Jill Lepore, who writes a lot for The New Yorker, and who has just written two kind of monumental histories of the United States, one of the Constitution and one of the pursuit of American rights. There are ways to do this that, you know, make clear how, I mean, you said the history is problematic. You know, that's one of the words that the White House was taking issue with the Smithsonian using.
There's also another angle as well, which is the effort that you see periodically to really invent parts of the American past. I mean, the person who's really guilty of this is J.D. Vance, who said, you know, the United States was founded as a Christian nation. Well, I got news for you. Christianity is not mentioned in the Declaration or the Constitution. I don't even know that.
Nature's God. Nature's God.
And that was done very, very deliberately, because actually most of these people were not particularly devout. And you know, that's in some ways even worse. It is a real problem. And we'll talk more about this in a moment, but one of my great fears is that when the pendulum swings, and, you know, I firmly believe, as you know, in the laws of political gravity, the pendulum will swing back, that, you know, it'll be like the Bourbon Restoration after the fall of Napoleon. They will have forgotten nothing and learned nothing. And you know, you'll be back where you started. I hope not. Certainly not if the Shield of the Republic has anything to say about it. But anyway.
Well, while we're on the subject of history, I think we should inform our viewers and listeners that we are going to inaugurate we were going to do this before the Atlantic published its really depressing article about the death of reading in America. But, you know, whatever other people are doing, you and I still spend a lot of time reading. And I think we've had a lot of authors on for books that we have thought well of, some books we didn't think so well of. I think in future, we're likely to, by mutual agreement, have people on who have either written books we're passionate about or who are authors we are passionate about. But we're also going to be reviewing some books that have come our way that speak to different subjects of interest, whether it's national security or history or warfare, the things that we normally devote our time to. So that's an advance warning for everybody.
Well, I hope people like it. And I think one of the other things we agreed is not just brand new books. We might bring together a cluster of books on a topic, and some of them may not be brand new. And that's, I think it's an important thing to, for us, as we encourage some of the readers out there, is don't just go for the new stuff. There are a lot of older books that are really repay a reading.
So yeah, back the virtue to Jackass, of all books.
What is your, you said you had another jackassery.
Oh, my second jackassery is the gift that the host of the NATO summit this week, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey, gave to all the heads of government, which was a Turkish hand-tooled .357 Magnum with the name of each recipient etched in it, and live ammunition, 6 gold bullets to go into the revolver. As the historian, speaking of historians, Simon Montefiore, tweeted, this is the sort of, macho mafia wannabe authoritarian dictator's idea of what all of his fellow wannabes wants to get as a gift.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot we should talk about that summit. Let me just throw in my jackassery, and then we can return to the various things that were going on there. So my jackassery really is a kind of a collective award to those leaders of the Democratic Party who enthusiastically or reluctantly endorsed Graham Plattner until it just became absolutely impossible. And, I have to say, just watching that spectacle of hypocrisy stunned me. So, all these people who under other circumstances would be saying, believe the women, didn't believe the women. All those people would be willing to denounce somebody as a fascist. Totenkopf, okay, so he had it for a couple of decades.
Could have known? How many,
what
red flags were there?
This is a candidate who was not vetted, who was, as somebody said, I don't know whether it's The Atlantic or Times or something. So this is a D.C. political operative's idea of what a working class hero is. That is to say, a guy whose grandfather was a famous and wealthy architect, whose father is a wealthy lawyer, who went to a whole bunch of private schools, who, interned on Capitol Hill, who did go to war, enlisted in the Marines, but bills himself as a victim of the war, even though he reenlisted three or four times, and who was clearly totally, utterly unfit to be a senator of the United States of America for Maine. And it really was a piece of jackassery. There's, as with all of our pieces of jackassery, I think, there's a serious issue here. And the serious issue is that, there is this kind of demonic energy on the hard left. It is sweeping a lot before it. It is reckless. It is unfortunately, though, also politically somewhat skilled. There was a piece in the Free Press by Evan Barker saying, look, what's happened is, because he had been one of them and he eventually had the good sense to break from them, saying, look, what's happened is these people have now developed their own political operatives and, the kind of machinery. But there was also a number of people have pointed out that they are using the Democratic Party, which they're intending to kind of eat out from the inside and then move on to something else. These are not Democrats. And meanwhile, the Democratic establishment is just sort of paralyzed, does not know how to deal with these people, cannot confront them ideologically, is just trying to figure out on issues like Israel, which we can talk about more later as well, how do you appease them enough so they don't come after you, which, as we all know, means they'll come after you sooner or later. I mean, you're not going to, these are not, ideologues of this kind are not appeasable. These are people who don't know how to govern, who are, in many cases, have disgraceful, truly disgraceful opinions on the record about all kinds of things and all kinds of behaviors, like wiping their hands on the American flag, and who will probably, hopefully, get clobbered in a number of places, but in any case, don't represent where most Americans are. So, you know, one big award for jackassery to the Democratic Party. I don't know what your views of this are.
No, I quite agree. I mean, I think this DSA takeover of the Democratic Party is something Democratic leaders really need to take seriously. It is, as you know, Bill Galston said when we had him on, I think it was in the spring, or maybe it was the fall, I'm losing track now, but he pointed out that this is not the DSA that was founded by Michael Harrington, which was a group of relatively tame, you know, sort of social Democrats. This is a group of hard-edged Marxists who don't have any truck with the Democratic Party, are just using it for ballot access. And this is the kind of thing that the kind of liberal democratic establishment in the 1940s and 1950s, during the Cold War, knew how to deal with. I mean, they basically kicked the communists out of the labor movement and they kicked them out of the Democratic Party. You would think that the example of what happened to the GOP when the MAGA crowd took over would be enough of a warning sign that people would take this seriously. And I hope people do start to take it seriously because, you know, we already are afflicted as our publisher, Sarah Longwell, has said repeatedly, by a politics in which we have one party that's become an authoritarian threat to democracy and the other one that's very bad at politics. That was a bad situation to be in, but to have two authoritarian parties would be catastrophic.
Yeah, completely agree. All right, so let's talk about the summit. Let me give you the brighter view.
I knew you would.
Reprising our the doom versus gloom conversation. So on the one hand, you know, Trump said awful things. It was disgusting, you know, trying to fly there in his cuttery jet, although interestingly enough, he couldn't go back.
Fly back
on it, which is for security reasons, because they were afraid the Iranians would try to kill him. He did say some awful things about Greenland and so on. But things he said about Ukraine were fine, actually very supportive. He's, you know, was notably enthusiastic about licensed production of Patriot missiles. He then, in his characteristically sort of insane way, said, "Oh yeah, no, there was a lot of love in that room, meeting with all the."
Loved the gun, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he loved the gun too. But you know, I here's my basic feeling. I think the Europeans, and I would include the Canadians in this, because Mark Carney is, in some ways, he's milking this for all it's worth, but I think he's also sincere. You know, there are two different strategies that they're using. There's the Mark Rutte strategy, which is you flatter him, you play along with him, you agree with him. And the truth is, as we both have said, he's got a point about things like burden sharing. You cajole him, you know, you work. And then on the other hand, there's the other view, which I mean, I think Mark Carney represents from Canada, but there are others out there as well. The French are usually this way, saying, "Okay, we have to begin building our own systems. We have," and you're beginning to see things. So the apparently French bureaucrats are really unhappy. They can't use Microsoft Teams anymore. They have to use their, you know, their clunky substitute. They're trying to get off Starlink, but I think that, frankly, from their point of view, I think that also makes sense. Now, they can't completely de-link, and I think there's a danger that people will succumb to that fantasy. They can't. And for Canada, actually, by the way, I have to say this is particularly ridiculous. You know, the U.S. and Canadian economies, and not just economies, you know, you wander around Calgary, there's loads and loads of Americans here. I mean, a lot of the fucking Bronco riders here are from Texas. But I think it makes a certain amount of sense, and I think it kind of works. Now with Trump, you can never tell, and he could always really blow things up. But and maybe it's just the soft bigotry of low expectations. But I think given where we could have been, it's not as not as bad as it could be. All right. Now tell me while I'm wrong.
No, I agree. It's not as bad as it could be. But that that is, you know, what Daniel Patrick Moynihan would, you know, call the dumbing down of our standards. You know, NATO gave a, you know, NATO had a communique in which it reiterated Article 5. Hooray. You know, the raison d'etre of the alliance has been, you know, restated, and no one, you know, no one had a, you know, a conniption fit. Look, I mean, the summit, actually, there are some very positive things out of the summit. As you said, there's commitments to make defense investments. There's commitments to provide Ukraine with additional financing for defense. There was the reiteration of the basic, not just Article 5, but NATO's deterrent strategy as a mixture of conventional, nuclear, cyber, and other you know, domains. So all of that's, you know, good, you know, and all of, for all of his bluster and tantrums about Greenland and about cutting off all trade with Spain, you know, et cetera, you know, the alliance has survived, and that's a good thing. I agree with you. There are some downsides, however, which we should be aware of. I have a slightly different take than you about how the Europeans now see him. I think what you said was true until recently. I think at this summit, I think it became apparent to a lot of them that he is in some early stage of dementia and that they don't take him seriously at all anymore. I mean, he's just not taken seriously. And that for the president of the United States as the leader of the alliance is a very bad thing. That's not a good thing. I mean, the fact that he called, you know, talked about the, you know, first of all, he could barely walk off the plane. You know, Erdogan had to sort of guide him. You know, he was wandering off just the way Joe Biden used to do. I mean,
well, mention the Islamic Republic of Japan.
I was about to go there, the Islamic Republic of Japan, and he called Zelensky President Putin at their press conference, you know. So
Zelensky Putin.
Yeah, what's the difference? You know, all have, they, you know, both have, you know, names that are hard to pronounce. You know, I think they just don't take him seriously. And I, that, as I said, is a very bad thing. I wrote about something else about the summit that particularly perturbed me, which is that there was a conspiracy of silence about what is going on in the host country, where the president is literally destroying Turkish democracy. He's closing the opposition party, choosing his own opponent, displacing, you know, duly elected mayors, 45 of whom from the opposition party he's just removed. You know, they used to use this tactic against the Kurdish party because the Kurds were a minority that they, now it's just being used as a tool of general political control against the main opposition party, in the face of some serious electoral losses and ongoing economic problems of which really Erdogan is largely the author and which he's proven incapable of taming is persistent inflation that's running in Turkey at 30-40%. So, you know, despite the fact that the EU rapporteur for Turkey gave a in June delivered himself of an absolute firecracker of a report about all this, and that it was adopted by a vast majority of the European Parliament with a resolution calling for sanctions against senior Turkish officials who've been involved in some of this anti-democratic activity. Not a word was said about this by anybody. On the contrary, the president was lauding Erdogan as a great friend who's been very loyal. He's done everything I asked him to do. I'm going to take the sanctions for Turkey's purchase of a Russian air and missile defense system, the S-400, off, and we're going to put them back in the F-35 program, which is not a very good idea. It also happens to be a violation of law right now. And that, I mean, it was not just that, you know, Trump has a business relationship in Turkey because he's got a very lucrative licensing agreement for the Trump Tower in Istanbul, but you know, he also has a web of other personal and family relationships with the Erdogan family. But it's not just that. It's that, you know, the European leaders, because they knew Trump had this relationship with Erdogan, dared not say a word because they wanted Erdogan to, you know, the Erdogan-Trump relationship to help guarantee a successful summit. And they got their wish. I mean, that's sort of what happened at the dinner.
Do you think that's the only reason for it? Or because, I mean, I'm not sure how courageous most of the European leaders would normally be on this anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that Kaja Kallas and some of the others who, you know, are very frequently critics of human rights violations in Russia and, you know, elsewhere would have said something about this. I mean, this was, I mean, look, there's, you know, part of it is there are other authoritarians in Europe. I mean, even though Orban is now out, there, you know, Fico is still in Slovakia, Babiš in Czech Republic. They share a lot in common with Erdogan's kind of populism, and they haven't gone nearly as far as he has in damaging their own democracies. But, you know, they are somewhat sympathetic, I think, to him. But it doesn't change, I think, the popular view in Europe, which is very, very skeptical and critical of Turkey.
We really, one of the things we need to put on the agenda of the coming year is really a serious deep dive on Turkey, because there's so much going on there. I mean, that part is obviously important. The extent to which Turkey really dominates Syria in certain respects, I think, is very, very interesting. The role the Turks are trying to play in Central Asia, where, by the way, we're also actually playing more than one might think. And this is, I think, one of the areas actually where you can say Trump foreign policy has been normal at some level in terms of relationship with Armenia and Azerbaijan and places like Kazakhstan. The Turks have a formidable military and an even more formidable military industry in some ways. That's important.
That's a very important part of why the Europeans have been quiet also.
Right. Well,
they know that Turkish defense industry is absolutely crucial to the reindustrialization of European defense.
I was going to say. And then they have a complex relationship with Russia and with Iran. And, you know, one of the things that they've been doing is...
And Israel.
Oh, well, that's... Alas, I don't think that one's complicated anymore. I think it's just it's mainly hostility. Although, you know, there's also under the table kinds of things that I think have always existed there. You know, then they've been working on developing this network of pipelines, basically to try to bypass the Strait of Hormuz, which we'll be talking about in a bit. Plus, you know, they're in Libya, and
Azerbaijan. They changed the battlefield calculus between Azerbaijan and Armenia. They changed it in Libya too.
Yeah. So, you know, and I have to say, I wish I were. In retrospect, I think back on our conversation with our friend Henri Barki, who's a very shrewd observer of Turkey, and he was, as I recall, fairly confident that the sort of neo-Ottomanism stuff goes away after Erdogan. And of course, time will tell, because like all dictators, Erdogan is mortal. But I'm no longer quite so convinced as I was. I mean, I think what we're seeing is the emergence of a regional power. Now, it's interesting that it's a regional power, which, as you pointed out, on one hand had a terrific almost half a century from an economic point of view, but is now in deep trouble because of mismanagement with inflation and what have you. But it's a major regional power with sort of a lopsided economic base, as far as I can figure out. So there's a lot of very interesting.
I think they also don't understand that Neo-Ottomanism rings one way in Turkish ears, rings very differently in Arab ears.
You mean the Arabs might not have such fond memories?
No, not at all. You know, and
yeah, although, you know, interesting fact. So the original nationalists in particularly in Iraq, the anti-English, and then the, in some ways the origins of the Ba'ath Party, comes from Arab officers who had served in the Turkish army during World War One. You know, we
oh, right. Yeah.
This is one of the reasons why it is good to go back to history. People may have seen Lawrence of Arabia and think that there was this massive Arab revolt. Actually, there were a lot of Arab soldiers, including officers, who were serving in the Ottoman Empire, who were willing to break when the time came. But I was told at the time of the Battle of Mosul that that's actually one of the reasons why Mosul was a particularly tough nut. This had always been the sort of the home of kind of the military caste of the Ottoman that part of the Arab world that served in the Ottoman Empire. But
yeah,
plenty to discuss there. Should we?
On Ukraine, I'd like to, on the summit, just one thing, which I think is important to note, which is, you know, as you said, the mood music between Trump and Zelensky was way better than it's ever been. And the president seemed to go along with all the things Europeans wanted to do to support Ukraine. All of that's good. The big news that the president broke was the idea of a license for co-production of Patriot missile defense interceptors for Ukraine. And that is great from the PR and symbolism point of view. I just want to make sure that our viewers and listeners understand this is not likely to happen anytime soon. Because as the president said, the companies that produce the Patriot interceptor, the Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, we're not consulted about this. There's a lot of intellectual property and source code that needs to be protected in any kind of co-production arrangement. There are other factors besides just the manufacture of the missile. One of the limiting factors for the ability of U.S. industry to boost the numbers of interceptors it produces a year, which is something like 600, is that there's a shortage of Seekers, which are built by Boeing, which is a subcontractor to Lockheed and Raytheon in the production of this missile. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. It's really much more symbolic than it is
real. As a symbol, it's pretty good. Maybe we could just say a few words about what we think is actually happening. First, it's very striking to me the success of this Ukrainian deep strike campaign, both in terms of Crimea, but also they are hitting these targets very, very deep in Russia in their hydrocarbon industry with extreme precision. And I don't know, since I no longer have clearances, but I would not be in the slightest surprised if a lot of this is precision intelligence that we've been passing on to the Ukrainians about exactly what piece of that refinery is the one you want to hit. You actually first put me on this, but I now have seen one or two stories that there may be more Chinese military assistance going to Russia than has been publicly discussed. Do you want to say anything about that?
There is, yes. I mean, there's a major investigative piece that's been was released, I guess, today by the insider, Michael Weiss, who we've had on as a guest of this show, Christo Grozov, who is one of the leading forces behind Bellingcat and who identified the poisoners of Alexei Navalny, along with Der Spiegel and Le Monde. And they've gotten a hold of a tranche of Chinese documents that show a variety of kind of, Chinese assistance to the Russians goes well beyond, you know, just dual use technologies, although that's a big part of it. I mean, the material that the Chinese have provided in terms of machine building and other capabilities have enabled Russia's defense industry to go on a, you know, three shift a day, 24/7 production cycle. But in particular, the report draws attention to joint missile defense efforts, which include things like taking down Starlink. So Elon Musk, you know, be advised. Just one more example of this intensifying cooperation between and among Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. And it's a very worrying problem for us, I think, in the long run here.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Iran, so maybe we should shift to that. So here's my opening gambit. Last time we talked, I had probably assessed Trump as being a little bit more resolute than he turned out to be. And of course, that we didn't have a chance to talk about the MOU, that surrender document masquerading as an agreement. And I was prepared to come on Shield of the Republic today and say, my friend Eric, I will eat a full lunch of crow. Now, since we've
just be an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, since hostilities have resumed and he's still, you know, not willing to concede Iranian control, at the most, I think an hors d'oeuvre of crow tartare is about as far as I'm.
I don't know. That's worse. I think that's worse than having to eat a cooked crow. But that's okay.
Would be pretty bad.
To each his own taste. Chacun son goût.
So, what is striking to me is there is clearly there are limits to which Trump. Beyond which Trump will not go. So he's not willing simply to capitulate. It does reinforce one sense that J.D. Vance kind of blew his assignment in terms of negotiating a deal, or at least in terms of explaining it to the president. It was an incredibly poorly drafted, awful document where we and the Iranians had bad, totally different understandings. Point one. Point two, as I think I said on one of our earlier broadcasts, neither party here knows how to be a graceful winner or a graceful loser. And I think what's happened is the Iranians are intoxicated with what they view as a massive success. I think that may be a mistake on their part. Third thing I would say is I find a lot of the commentary that I read, which is... the main theme is, boy, Trump is really in a pickle now. You know, the United States is in a corner. It all assumes that the Iranians are the only ones who have cards and that we don't, and that it's not a war. And in war, both sides get surprised and bad things happen to both sides. I think people are making an interpretive mistake there by just being, and I think it's frankly because so many of the analysts and the commentators hate Trump so much and despise him so much that they can't look at this in a level-headed way. The fourth thing, though, and I want to hear your thoughts. I was struck at looking at the Khamenei funeral, which we should also talk about because there are a lot of interesting aspects. One thing is that they were carrying these huge banners saying, "We will kill Trump." And I don't think they're kidding. And I suspect that Trump doesn't think they're kidding. And I think that'll turn out to be a big mistake on their part.
Maybe. We'll see. I guess my take on this is, first of all, I agree with you that the Iranians are at great risk of overplaying their hand. And Nate Swanson, who worked these issues in the Biden NSC, had a piece in Foreign Affairs, a week or two ago, which he made exactly this point, which is that to the degree that the Iranians push their advantage in the Gulf, they are going to incite a reaction from the Americans that makes it harder for them to accomplish what they want to do. After all, the MOU, as you point out, that J.D. Vance negotiated, says no tolls for 60 days. Doesn't say anything about what happens after the 60 days, which leaves open the question of tolls. And when J.D. Vance clarified this by saying, we expect there to be no tolls, in the long term. He didn't quite say perpetuity, but, forever. Nothing was said about environmental fees, insurance fees, et cetera, which are obviously a toll by any other name. I think it's quite striking that the United States is actually in these negotiations not stood for the principles that's traditionally stood for, which is freedom of the seas and freedom of navigation of straits. I suppose one could argue that, not all straits are created equal. After all, the Turks control the Bosporus under the Treaty of Montreux. But it's, I mean, that's a kind of different case. There are a lot of reasons why a lot of people will be very upset if the Iranians actually are able to monetize this at some level or to control it in some way. The president has shown that there are limits to his tolerance for the Iranians doing what they're doing in the Strait. However, I wouldn't confuse that, no matter what he says, with a disposition to go back to major combat operations. I don't think he wants to do that. I think there are a lot of reasons why he doesn't want to do that, including congressional opposition, including the fact that the Department of Defense is running out of money and they can't get supplemental funding right now to keep the department going. This last two days, they were firing off a lot of Tomahawks, as your colleagues at CSIS have already demonstrated. We have drawn down our munitions very, very dramatically, leaving us very, very exposed if we were to get involved in a conflict in some other part of the world, notably including the Indo-Pacific. And of course, he's got the midterms coming up, and he doesn't want the disruption, the economic disruption that, you know, the Iranians have proven they can create, even if it's less than what people thought. I mean, it hasn't been it hasn't been the economic Gadadamarung that people thought. But, you know, if you looked at the Financial Times today, you would have seen that producer prices at the gateway to Chinese factories, where most of the manufactured goods in the world are coming from, have been up like 4, 5, 6, 7% in the last month, in part because of the disruption. It's not just the oil. It's the sulfur. It's the, you know, it's the fertilizer, which is driving up food prices. So, and I don't think that, you know, we have a military. I mean, I think if we've shown anything, it's that air power alone cannot solve this problem with the Iranian regime.
Right. I think all those things are true. But I think it's another way in which people tend to conduct one-sided analyses, where, you know, our mistake is backing somebody into a corner where they have no choice but to lash out. And even if you think, I think what people may not fully appreciate is, or what the Iranians may not fully appreciate is, they may very well back Trump into a corner where, despite everything you say, all of which is totally true, he'll have no choice. And what I'm particularly thinking of, so they said that they hit 80 American bases. I have no idea if they hit any. But if they begin lobbing missiles and, God forbid, a bunch of Americans get killed, I think Trump will go kind of nuts. And you might say it's illogical. You might say there's no, you know, theory of victory. You might say you do not get a passing grade in Professor Cohen's or Professor Edelman's strategy course, but he may go ahead and do it anyway. There's also, I mean, what would be interesting to know, the strikes that we're conducting, we both know, when the military begins doing these kinds of things, they're usually not just saying, well, we'll just find something to drop bombs on. They'll say, let's drop bombs in such a way that it will facilitate further operations if we're called upon to do that. So I would assume that we're doing things like taking out air defenses, and what that can, you know, part of the purpose of that is so that you can then fly in and use much cheaper munitions to do the same sort of thing. And we're doing.
I'm sure that's what they were using things like Tomahawks for. According to CENTCOM, they went after small boats. They've gone after a lot of targets like the ones you just described along the coast. They've also hit some infrastructure targets, which I think is intended as a signal to the Iranians.
Yes.
They hit Karg Island, and not the energy infrastructure, but they hit the island. And Trump was very clear that, you know, his comments were very clearly a warning that, you know, if this keeps up, we have not gone after your energy infrastructure, but we can and we will. Similarly, they went after a bridge that, you know, leads to Mashhad, where Khamenei is meant to be buried, which is complicating the funeral arrangements, which may have something to do with the banners about we're going to kill Trump. I don't know. I'm speculating here. But I would point out that that's not strictly a military target. I mean, of course, bridges, you can always say, you know, bridge is a military target because you can move military equipment over it. That bridge is not in a place where we're conducting, you know, operations. It's not strictly speaking a military target. So, again, I think it's a signal that they're intending to send. I think there's a limit to how much you can do. Now, as you say, if there are a lot of U.S. casualties, I mean, we don't know exactly what happened at the bases that they targeted because the administration's been very quiet about this. I mean, as we know from the first round of fighting, the Iranians did a lot more damage to our bases than people originally realized.
And that is coming out. That is coming out more and more, by the way.
Yeah, and I mean that's going to be I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. That's going to be a problem down the road because presumably we're either going to have to relocate or we're going to have to rebuild those bases, and someone's going to have to pay for that. And as you know well, foreign military construction money is the hardest money of all to get out of the U.S. Congress. Everybody wants to build a base in their district, but nobody wants money going to foreigners to, you know, build bases in their country. So that means that the administration is going to be knocking on doors in Abu Dhabi and in Bahrain and in Qatar, you know, and Doha and in Riyadh saying, you know, we're here with our tin cup and we expect you guys to pony up and rebuild these bases. I noticed, by the way, I think they went after Jordan today,
yes.
The Iranians.
Yes.
So they're you know, horizontally escalating against U.S. bases, not just in the Gulf.
What they haven't done yet, which would also be another major escalatory step, is to go after Israel.
Right.
Because the Israelis can and would hit back. The Israelis did this kind of signaling about particularly the oil infrastructure at the end of the last really active round of fighting. And it's significant that the Iranians have been controlled enough not to do that. But I, as you know, from the very beginning, I pushed back at the idea that the Iranians are simply extraordinarily strategically savvy. I'm not so sure.
No, I mean, they wouldn't have gotten themselves into this mess if they were that strategically savvy. You just mentioned Israel. Rahm Emanuel, who I know you've been somewhat fond of as a potential Democratic presidential nominee, you touted his op-ed in the Washington Post that I didn't think so well of. So, you know, he gave a speech in Israel. Tell us what you thought, Elliot.
Well, he is clearly toying with the idea of running for president. He knows that the Democrats have really turned against Israel in a fundamental way. He himself has always been hostile to Netanyahu, which, as are a lot of other people. I thought it was a rather shrewd move to say, well, I'm not going to throw spitballs across the Atlantic. I'm going to go there and tell them to their face. Now, if you know anything about the politics of Tel Aviv University, where he gave the speech, there are many, many, many people there who really hate Bibi Netanyahu with a visceral hatred that far exceeds Rahm Emanuel's, but I think he had a point. I think it is important to actually kind of deliver a message to the Israelis so that they fully understand the kind of damage that's been done. Some do, some don't. The things that are, you know, there's some awful people like Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir. I mean, these are bad, bad people, and they don't belong in the Israeli government. I also think it's actually now, I think, a consensus view, including in the Israeli national security elite, that the time has come to really walk away from American military aid as opposed to purchases. Now, you know, as you and I both know, one of the issues here has nothing to do with Israel. It has to do with Egypt, because the Egyptians get a lot of military aid premised on the fact that the Israelis are getting military aid. This is all a result of the way in which the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty was negotiated. So he was delivering that message as well. Do I think this will have any impact whatsoever on the Israeli government? I don't think so. I mean, Bibi is fighting it's domestic politics. He's got a serious challenger. It looks like Gadi Eisenkot, the former chief of staff, who's a very have you ever met him? I've met him a couple times.
I haven't met him, but I've followed his career.
His English was not particularly good when I met him, but we were able to speak in Hebrew. He's very shrewd, tough. He is something of a hero, lost his son in the fighting immediately after October 7th, and I think a nephew as well. And, you know, Bibi is clearly aging. He's had serious health problems. So it's conceivable that he could be turned out, which I think would change things for the best. I do think it's going to be a difficult test for the leadership of the Democratic Party, dealing with a hard left wing, which really, in some ways, insanely defines itself by hostility to Israel, frequently, to my mind, slipping over the edge into pure undiluted anti-Semitism. I mean, when Zoran Mamdani begins talking about the monsters among us, you know, this is not that far from just sort of classical anti-Semitic vitriol. They're going to have to figure out how to deal with it. And I think Emmanuel was fairly smart to try to do it this way. Do I actually think it'll work? And do I think he's going to end up being the Democratic candidate for president? Probably not.
No, I agree with that. I generally agree with your assessment. I thought, I mean, by and large, I thought a lot of the criticisms were reasonably delivered. I thought he may have gone a little bit overboard about how Israel has become, you know, isolated internationally because of Bibi and what he's done, in the sense that some of that isolation has nothing to do with anything that Israel has actually done. I mean,
absolutely.
But in general, I thought it was a message that needed to be heard. I mean, it's interesting that in Israel, Trump's political popularity, which was astronomical six months ago, has completely cratered.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the secrets about the Israelis is, for all their kind of tough guy image, they desperately want to be loved and feel that they've got somebody who's really in their corner in a visceral way. And I think they really did view the way the war ended, which was, you know, sort of dictated by Trump, as he himself said, with an MOU that left them completely out in the cold, and with a mechanism in Lebanon that also left them completely out in the cold. Even though they're one of the parties, it shocked them deeply. And it
shouldn't have, but it did.
You know, there are people, sometimes some of the most naive people I know are some of the also, at the same time, pride themselves on being hard-eyed, cynical realists. And actually, that's one of the ways you can really set yourself up to make some naive assumptions about other people. So, yeah. All right. Well, listen, it's vacation time. So you tell me about yours and I'll tell you about mine.
All right. Well, I and my wife took a lovely cruise down the Danube. We started in Budapest and we ended up in, as you said, Transylvania. We traversed some of rural Hungary, Croatia, Serbia, Bulgaria, then Bucharest, and then a couple of days in Transylvania, where we went to Bran Castle, which is the castle that Bram Stoker actually, he never set foot in Romania when he wrote Dracula, but he'd read accounts, travelers' accounts in the British Museum Library about this castle where Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, twice set foot, but didn't own it, didn't live there. But the castle itself is pretty impressive. It began as a fortification in the 14th century and then was added onto afterwards, really got high ground. It's in the, you know, Carpathians and beautiful view and lovely, well-appointed ground. So it was a lot of fun to go there. I guess my takeaway, having not been in Central Europe in about 20 years, was a couple of takeaways. One was, from my previous travels, I would have expected that Budapest would be way ahead of Bucharest and Romania, and that wasn't the case. And it was palpable that under Orban, Hungary lost 16 years. And people are still celebrating his defeat, by the way, while we were there. I mean, and that was like 2-3 months ago. A lot of anger about the money that was stolen, as that's come out, as Peter Magyar has, led the expose of all these EU funds that, you know, went ultimately into Orban and his cronies' pockets instead of for the benefit of the Hungarian people. So that was one takeaway. The other related takeaway is, you know, for all the criticism of the EU, EU development funds have made a huge difference to those countries, all of them. I mean, the number of tourist sites we went to that, you know, when you looked at it and read into it, you discovered had been refurbished or rebuilt with EU funds is, it's everywhere. And so for all of its flaws, and there are plenty, the EU's really done a lot for those, Central European, Eastern European countries to help move them along. And although they've made lots of progress, you know, they're still afflicted by everywhere corruption and anger at the old communist elite that basically, you know, took advantage of the fall of communism to enrich themselves and become capitalists.
Interesting.
It's still very palpable.
Yeah. You know, Poland is another country where EU development money was hugely consequential in terms of building infrastructure. Oh, yeah. You drive on the highways in Poland. They're lovely. There's a reason for that. So the other
thing I would say is, you know, we have short historical memories in the United States, and we can barely remember what happened 5 minutes ago. Historical memories in that part of the world are much longer and very much directed at Russians and Turks.
Yeah, I remember when I visited Hungary only once, but when I went there, I mean, the stuff about the Russians for sure, but also the Turks. I mean, even though.
And that was in the 17th century, but, you know, still.
I mean, that is something that we tend to forget, that many other cultures, you know, history lives. I guess that's connected to what I'll talk a bit about. We're on our current trip really is vacation, but previously I had a bit over a week in France, first at the Chateau Tocqueville, which still belongs to the family of Alexis de Tocqueville in Normandy. And it was an annual conversation that they hold for basically essentially 2 days at the chateau. The current Comte de Tocqueville, who I have to say looks like his distinguished ancestor, showed a small group of us some of Alexis de Tocqueville's original manuscripts. I think Democracy in America is at Yale, but the Ancien Régime and the Revolution, which is a wonderful and very interesting book, you actually see the manuscript was something. The conversations there were very interesting because the number of things that struck me. First, there were a couple of French politicians there. So two former prime ministers, Maurice Valls and Bernard Cazeneuve, plus some other MEPs. And I have to say, they're very literate people. So, you know, they're giving talks about the current world. They're talking about Tocqueville. And you can be pretty sure that an American politician would have turned to some, you know, research assistant and said, give me two sentences about this guy, Tocqueville. And these guys had read Tocqueville. I mean, it was very clear. You know, you listen to them, and you do see what happens when you come from a deep literary culture. That was very striking. There were a few Americans. It was mainly French people, some Europeans, a few Americans. The American panel, I have to give a shout out to Donna Brazile, who, former chair of the Democratic National Committee, African-American woman from New Orleans, who gave a wonderful talk on the, we were on a committee together. And she was unyielding in her criticism of Trump and unyielding in her discussion of American racial politics. And then she transitioned seamlessly into a celebration of the United States as, you know, a flawed country that's always aspiring and changing itself and developing. And, you know, it was a kind of positive representation of the United States to a foreign audience that, you know, you or I could not have pulled off for obvious reasons. And I went up to her after, as I said, you know, you just did our country such a service. She was really tremendously, she's a very impressive person. I then had a couple of days in Paris with some of our old friends, some new friends. So mainly people in government and that rather small, tight French national security establishment. And a couple of things that struck me there. First, I think it's sort of a moderate sort of pessimism, not just because of the United States. You know, as one diplomat friend said, look, we never trusted you people anyway, so we're not getting too excited. But, you know, they have a terrible budget deficit, which limits them. Macron is pretty clearly increasingly ineffective. They are worried about the rise of the right, and they don't think this is like Maloney. They said the comparison with Maloney is not actually a good one. She's been part of the system for a long time. These guys
they're
are
talking not, about. You're talking about the rise of the right in their own country.
Yeah, very much in their own country. They worry about the decline of Great Britain. They said, look, those are our natural partners. They worry about Russia. So the new national security strategy document is overwhelmingly focused on Russia, and that's brand new. And apparently it was not that easy for the French army to go along with that because they tend to look more south and at sort of North Africa and at Africa. So that was interesting. And then just a couple of days in Paris, including as you and I were once wont to do when we were there on diplomatic missions, cruising the bookstores. And there, you know, the weight of history is different.
I think the way we used to describe that was economic support and cultural orientation activities.
Yes, right. I thought it was cultural support activities. It was, I seem to remember that phrase. So they, an awful lot about World War II. So the big movie release, five-hour, two-part thing on De Gaulle in 1940 to 1945. The French just interred Marc Bloch in the Pantheon, which is where all the greatest Frenchmen are interred. So he was a very famous medieval historian who, in his 50s, you know, was a reserve officer in World War II, writes a stinging account of it called The Strange Defeat, which is still a very powerful read, that was in the underground, was tortured, and eventually shot two weeks after D-Day. Bookstores were filled with his books, biographies, but also books about Vichy and various other figures there. So you really felt, you do feel the weight of of history there. And I just wrote a piece which just came out in The Atlantic on this old, never easy, but still very important and very valuable alliance, which, you know, we should, like all of our alliances, we should cultivate. And now I'm in Canada. I have to say Western Canada has a very different feel than Eastern Canada. There are a lot of cowboys running around, and we're about to head into the Rocky Mountains. So all I can say is giddy up.
All right. I'm gonna let you go. I just will say one thing, which is that when I worked for George Shultz, one of the things he always said, and I found that to be true in my, particularly towards the end of my government service as well. So the thing about the French, he says, is when you go and talk to them, said they always have a very global view of things.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think he found some of his British counterparts, even in the Thatcher era, like Francis Pym and even Peter Carrington, who later was a, you know, NATO Secretary General, to be kind of really pretty insular.
Yeah. The French look very smart, very well informed, as you say, a kind of a serious global view. I mean, it's really always worth hearing what they have to say. And the food is very good.
So it sounds like you're validating that totally apocryphal comment attributed to Jefferson, that every man has two countries, his own and France. He actually never said that. He wrote something in his autobiography kind of like that, which was, if you ask a well-traveled citizen, you know, what country would they like to live in? They will say, my own country, where my friends and relations are. But if you're what's your second choice, it would be France. But the actual Every Man Has Two Countries is actually a line that's given to Charlemagne in the 1875 Henri de Bournier play La Fille de Roland. And on that particular bit of pedantry, we'll end the show.
I was going to say, that is a very formidable piece of pedantry indeed.